Howdy and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from your high country public radio stations. I'm John Kovash. This month we revisit the subject of alternative energy. We have a report from Boulder on flexible fuel vehicles, and from Aspen, Colorado towns are buying into wind power.
It's the biggest wind site in the Rocky Mountains. There are about 70 machines there.
We talk with Colorado's own energy guru, Amory Lovins. It's hunting season. We have a report from the front lines.
Because I do not like bunny huggers.
And we have an update from Rocky Flats. A new study says downwinders have been lucky. For years, the city of Aspen has received a significant portion of its electricity from hydropower. Now, like a growing number of Colorado municipalities, Aspen is buying into wind power, Wyoming wind. Marilyn Gleason reports from KAJX.
In October, when the three blades of a towering late-model windmill spun into action, driven by the winds of south-central Wyoming, the 2,500 customers of Aspen's municipal electric utility began to draw 3% of their electricity from a clean, renewable energy source. It makes Aspen one of the top five U.S. cities in utilizing wind power, according to Randy Udall of Aspen's Community Office for Resource Efficiency. Even a 3% increase in renewable energy shifts the balance in a state where as much as 95% of the electricity is supplied by coal-burning power plants. Udall brokered an arrangement between the City of Aspen, the Platte River Power Authority, and the Municipal Energy Agency of Nebraska, Aspen's primary power supplier. The Platte River Power Authority owns and operates the wind farm near Medicine Bow, Wyoming. Since April 1998, it has sold power from two other turbines on the site through a green pricing program to the people of Fort Collins. By agreeing to purchase all the power the turbine produces for the next 20 years, the Aspen utility got its own Vestas V47 turbine next to four others erected in September in this windswept Wyoming basin. John Bleem, Energy Services Manager for the Platte River Power Authority, looks over the row of five new turbines.
The farthest one to the south goes to Aspen. The next one up is Tri-State, dedicated to Tri-State. And then the next three are Fort Collins, Loveland, and Longmont, a combination of those. New Belgium Brewery is buying the output equivalent of one of those.
A break in the profile of the Rocky Mountains funnels prevailing winds northeast across the almost featureless sagebrush mesa, still within the embrace of the Rockies. Strong, steady winds first attracted the government to the site almost 20 years ago. The consistency and speed of the wind on this lonely intermountain plain make it one of the best sites in a much larger area that contains some of the world's best wind resources. The Saudi Arabia of wind stretches from Wyoming to the Dakotas and Idaho. Other wind farms not far from here generate electricity for Public Service Company of Colorado and for customers in distant states. Selling wind power is really an economic arrangement to pay for the turbines, like the $750,000 Vestas machines, in order to make wind power possible. An electron generated at Medicine Bow may never light up an Aspen Victorian, but Aspen customers pay to put wind power into the grid where electricity is stored. Udall points to the snow-covered hills in the distance, where many more turbines draw energy from thin air.
There's another wind site that we just can't see off on the horizon here, Maryland, just a few miles out of our view, is the biggest wind site in the Rocky Mountains. There are about 70 machines there. And that energy is being shipped to the northwest.
When you say that, they're not really shipping the electricity out there, they're just adding it into the grid.
They're putting it in the grid and they're paying for it there, and most likely the way the grid works, the electricity from these wind turbines won't ever get all the way to Oregon. You can't track an electron, so it's hard to know where any of this stuff actually ends up.
Inside the hollow towers of the turbines, power cables dangle from the turbine blades, connecting them to complex computers that meter the electricity produced, monitor all parts, and direct the operation of each machine. Power cables feed electrons into the grid via nearby power lines. When all five machines are switched on, Randy Udall says Aspen will add a little less pollution to western skies.
So each one of these machines that we're looking at will produce about 2 million kilowatt hours a year, and that's enough. It takes 1 pound of coal to produce a kilowatt hour, so each one of these machines will keep 2 million pounds of coal in the ground, and because you're not burning that coal, you're keeping 4 million pounds of carbon dioxide out of the air each year, and carbon dioxide is the leading greenhouse gas.
While the Wyoming turbine will only serve customers in the core of Aspen, Roaring Fork Valley and most Colorado residents can now choose wind power by participating in green pricing programs offered by Holy Cross Energy and by Public Service Company of Colorado. For Thin Air, from Aspen, Colorado and Medicine Bow, Wyoming, I'm Marilyn Gleason.
This year, Dodge, Ford, and GMC have come out with new flexible fuel vehicles that can burn unleaded gas or up to 85% ethanol. But Colorado drivers of the environmentally friendly cars will have a hard time finding E85 at the pump. May Jarrell reports from KGNU in Boulder.
E85 is a domestically produced alternative fuel made from distilling alcohol from a mixture of corn or other agricultural products, yeast, and water. After distilling the ethanol, the remaining product can be fed to livestock. Gas station owner Mark Rodenberg added an E85 pump and service center when he redid his underground tanks.
We were confronted I don't know if it was the state or the federal, to look at putting the E85, they needed a E85 fueling stop. And, of course, with this federal center being real close to us, it was kind of a natural for it.
Rodenberg Station, the Green Mountain Texaco, is near Denver. He says fleet managers are finding E85 a practical way to comply with the Energy Policy Act, which directs state and federal governments to reduce our reliance on foreign and depleting sources of energy and to favor renewable domestic fuels. Hal Smedley of the Colorado Corn Growers Association says eventually enough flexible fuel vehicles will be sold to justify more E85 pumps.
Vehicles that roll off of the assembly line in Detroit and other manufacturing locations are E85 vehicles, so that there is more commercial offering of these vehicles and a higher purchase and larger numbers of them all the time.
This year, Motor City is offering the Ford Taurus and Ranger, the Dodge Caravan, the GMC Sonoma, and Mazda with the flexible fuel option. The trick is finding a pump. Outside the Midwest, almost all the flexible fuel vehicles are still running on unleaded gas. Again, Hal Smedley.
We're in the process of establishing an infrastructure of refueling stations, or just filling stations. These are nothing particularly special. They're just like any other filling station. We try to locate them where we are beginning to see a concentration of E85-capable automobiles that are manufactured by Detroit. And it's the old problem of the chicken or the egg. What do you do, the car first or the fuel first? You try to do it all at the same time, and it's incredibly difficult and awkward in a startup phase.
While it can cost well over $1 million to put in a new gas station, planners say to convert an existing tank and dispenser probably costs less than $2,000. A new underground tank and dispenser would cost between $30,000 and $50,000 to install. Federal fleets bus tripled the number of alternative fuel vehicles between 1996 and 2006 under guidelines of the Energy Policy Act. Colorado is expecting 800 E85 vehicles this year for the Postal Service alone. flexible fuel technology allows for the transition. Jim Geitz of the Colorado Corn Growers Association explains.
A fuel sensor module, it determines the amount of oxygen, or in essence how much ethanol is in the fuel blend. It sends information to the computer for injection and timing changes, because gas and ethanol have different burn characteristics, and you just keep driving. So if you're away from an E85 filling source, you put straight gas in it, drive on back, and put E85 in it.
The fuel can be purchased for just about the same cost as premium gasoline at the pump in Denver.
You know, it's not cheap to send American GIs over to a foreign country to fight for oil.
Government Accounting Services information last year places the real cost of gasoline at up to 6 times the cost of ethanol, after security and cleanup costs are factored in. Hundreds of new flexible fuel vehicles ordered by local, state, and federal fleet managers should be joining the others already on the roads within the next 6 months. And their drivers may be asking, where's the E85? For Thin Air, this is Mae Jarrell.
This month, there's a new book out by Amory and Hunter Lovins, co-directors of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass. Natural Capitalism is about people who think they are creating the next industrial revolution. James Ray spoke with Amory Lovins recently in Washington, D.C. and sent this report to Thin Air.
Throughout the economy, the waste to be captured is just staggering. We've saved $150 or $200 billion a year worth of energy, but we're still wasting over $300 billion a year worth of energy.
Amory Lovins is co-CEO of the Rocky Mountain Institute. He says we have this kind of waste because we're still playing by the rules of the 200-year-old industrial revolution. We have huge populations and dwindling natural resources. We need a new set of rules, which he and co-authors Hunter Lovins and Paul Hawken call natural capitalism.
All the parts of a system work together, and if you don't make them work together to your advantage, they'll work against each other to your disadvantage.
A car, for example, is a complex system of parts. Change one thing, he says, like make the engine smaller, and it'll just be slower. But if you change the whole system, the savings multiply. Make it lighter, and not only does the smaller engine work, but then you can also use smaller brakes, smaller shocks, and so on.
Once we set the right criteria, often inspired by the way nature does things, all the pieces fall into place, and we don't have to compromise. That's a political process, not a design method. We find instead that we get every attribute we want, plus some more we weren't even smart enough to ask for.
But Lovins says a natural capitalism economy isn't just about smarter design to save natural resources. It's also about placing a higher value on the dignity and well-being of its people.
I think we will learn that markets, which are terrific at the short-term allocation of scarce resources, make an excellent servant, but a bad master and a worse religion. A lot of our social problems, shortages of work and hope, security and satisfaction, are simply reflecting the interlinked waste of resources, money, and people. The solutions are equally intertwined, and as soon as we stop wasting those three things, a lot of mutually reinforcing solutions start to come into play, and everything gets better but costs less. Human ingenuity is finding extraordinarily advantageous ways to save the earth for fun and for profit.
Those stories that wouldn't fit in the book Natural Capitalism can be found on the internet at www.naturalcapitalism.org. I'm James Ray. ¶¶
People who live downwind from the former Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant can breathe a collective sigh of relief. A 9-year, $15 million study just concluded that past radioactive and hazardous releases only posed a low cancer threat to nearby residents. The downwinders are not out of the woods yet. Still unfinished is the cleanup of lingering contamination from past fires, accidents, and poor waste management. From KGNU in Boulder, David Barrett Wilson reports.
Okay, we'll go ahead and go on back. We're going to be going into what's called a radiologically contaminated area. That means there's the potential for us to pick up some contamination.
In 1969, a huge fire erupted in this plutonium processing building at Rocky Flats. Plumes of black smoke were visible from nearby Denver suburbs. Only luck stopped the fire from spewing hundreds of pounds of cancer-causing and long-lived plutonium into nearby communities. The fire drew the public's eye for the first time to the dangers of building the bomb near a major metropolitan area along Colorado's Front Range. 30 years later, workers are decontaminating and decommissioning Building 776, one of the first steps in closing the door on this retired nuclear weapons plant. And those who have lived downwind from Rocky Flats are finally getting some clearer answers about what impact the plant's dangerous past could have had on them.
The lessons that we learned in this whole retrospective study is that we got very lucky. Those accidents could have gotten out of control, and especially the 69 fire.
For the past 9 years, chemistry professor Neil Schoenbeck has worked on the Rocky Flats Health Advisory Panel to provide public oversight for the most thorough examination of past accidents and fires at Rocky Flats and their potential impact on people living downwind.
The danger to the people off-site appears to be low. That's the best answer that science can come up with at this point.
The worst-case scenario from this study predicts a 1 in 10,000 risk of dying from cancer caused by Rocky Flats. The people most at risk would have lived east of the plant during the 1950s and 60s, when some of the worst fires and accidents occurred, most notably in 1957 and 69. Schoenbeck acknowledges there's a lot of uncertainty in the risk calculations, but compares the impact of Rocky Flats to radioactive fallout from atomic bomb tests that occurred before the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty in 1963. The results of this study have relieved many people who live around Rocky Flats, but for some longtime residents like Paula Olofsson-Gardine, this study leaves them still shaking their heads.
You know, you can count on both hands and all your toes how many people each person knows in that area that have been ill with potentially radiologically induced diseases or cancers. And so I think that this is not really the kind of study that was needed. It's a great study for people who want to be statistically reassured.
Olofsson-Gardine has long called for a thorough epidemiological study to show a more direct connection between people's exposure to Rocky Flats plutonium and other hazards and the resulting health problems. Health Advisory Panel member Neil Schoenbeck.
There's no question in any of our minds that it would be pointless to do one. And the reason is that the risks came in so low and there weren't very many people exposed. Now, that does not mean that Rocky Flats did not have a health impact. It's just that we will not be able to prove it.
10 years ago, this study would not have even been possible because of the secrecy that still shrouded the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons complex.
The DOE is much more open now. And
David Albright is another member of the Rocky Flats Health Advisory Panel.
When the health study started, there were real questions about whether the Department of Energy, and particularly the Rocky Flats plant, would help find the documents and then declassify them in order to accomplish a credible health study. Most things had been kept secret there.
This secrecy really started lifting in 1993 when Hazel O'Leary became head of the Department of Energy. In an effort to become more accountable to the public, she ordered tens of thousands of documents declassified, providing critical information about the history of the nuclear weapons complex, from which the risks associated with building the bomb could be assessed by the public. While Albright acknowledges the information gathered for their study is incomplete, things could be worse.
There's certainly forces now that would like to close things down, that it's too risky to be open. You know, mistakes happen, and therefore, you know, you don't want to declassify.
David Albright and Neil Schoenbeck both worry that the Department of Energy may be back on the road to losing public accountability following the recent scandal at Los Alamos, where nuclear weapons plants fell into Chinese government hands. If the walls of secrecy return to nuclear weapons facilities like Rocky Flats, as some members of Congress are calling for, Albright and Schoenbeck both believe the future risks from Rocky Flats will skyrocket.
I think that there are greater risks that lie ahead of us in the future than what we experienced in the past due to production. Nobody's ever cleaned up a site like that, ever. And so everything that they do will be new. It'll be for the first time. And in science, when you do something the first time, you can expect mistakes.
From Boulder, this is David Barrett Wilson reporting for Thin Air.
In most of rural Colorado, the welcome hunter banners are near universal this time of year. Most communities have long welcomed the extra flow of cash from out-of-state hunters. But in southwest Colorado, we found some local hunters who don't feel very welcoming. Brian Behuth from KRZA Alamosa earns his battle pay.
While driving up a well-tended and busy Forest Service road that ends at the southern edge of the Weminucha Wilderness area, we came upon two locals who did not wish to be identified, sighting in their rifles.
A bunch of these out-of-staters shot a cow and a horse, and, you know, they just, anything that moves in the brush, they just shoot, man. Need to, like, kick all these out-of-state hunters out for a couple years and then let all these locals to hunt, because there's so many people out here hunting, the locals can't even hunt. You know, it's more of a tourist trap now than anything for people. Locals can't even hunt. It's just to grab the money from the out-of-staters, you know, because they get, you know, $300 a tag, you know. I've seen a lot of these out-of-state hunters, they just come down here for the horns, you know, and they're on horses or whatever. They just get the head, they'll cut the head off and take a few backstraps and leave the whole carcass there to rot. I ran across 5 or 6 carcasses last year that were just laying there rotten just with the heads gone, like they're just trophy hunting, you know. And all of us down here, we're just trying to survive, you know. We kill something and we put it in our freezer to, you know, to get us through the winter. And these guys come down here and kill off everything and just take the head, you know, and leave everything else to rot, which I think is kind of, you know, baloney. And we went down the road down here. We were coming down here and we counted 20 cars coming in here from Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, all these places, you know.
I'm Chad Jenkins. I'm from Springdale, Arkansas.
This hunting camp was gear heavy. A 20 by 15 tent, 6 ATVs, a wood stove, and several trucks.
Well, we're pretty well set up. We brought pretty much everything in the house. We've got the wood stove. We've got everything.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We've got everything set up. 2 tables. We're set up to cook and everything. Just go up there and try to find them. Just get up there, try to find some good sign, and get in amongst them, see what happens.
As the sky darkened, we stopped by another hunting camp.
I'm Stan McMahon from Mahia, Texas. Yeah, I got a 5x5 today. Got pretty lucky. He's still up in the woods. I got him up in the woods. We're going to go drag him out tomorrow.
This anonymous hunter didn't take hunting criticism very well.
Because I do not like bunny huggers. I will debate with them.
This woman was along for the camping.
They respect me and I respect them. Everything they do is legal, and I've got my little naturalist. I got my woman side about everything, and, you know, I love the animals. I love to look at them and I love to see them, you know, so they got their view, I got mine.
Next stop, the Buck Stop Game Processing Center. Elk heads littered the parking lot. First, we chat with Dave Mapstone, taxidermist. He was sizing an elk head with calipers, preparing to remove the skin from the skull.
These are the measurements you need, so
you know what size form to buy for your head. This guy is 10 3/4 inches from the nose to the eye. So, gotta write that. There's three basic measurements you take from nose to eye, from nose to back of skull, and around circumference of the neck without the hair on after it's been skinned.
Is that a bear head over there?
That's a bear head sitting right there. It's a big old bear, too. This bear went 450 pounds. One of the biggest bears we've got around these parts. I've been here 4 years and haven't seen one quite this big. It's a beautiful bear. He's got his hair 6-8 inches long. He's a fantastic bear. He's going to be a rug. I'm going to measure him out and pull the skin off his face. And he'll be ready for... Then I'll put him in the freezer, and the guy will have to keep him froze until he gets him home. What I'm doing now is loosening the hide from around the butts of the elk horn. That way you don't get any cuts, and it's a real nice, smooth fit, so whoever's mounting this won't have any trouble putting this elk head together.
This man, calling himself Jeremy, was drenched in elk blood.
Oh, I'm the skinner. So do all the skinning.
What do you do?
Oh, they bring them in skinned with guts, without guts. I string them up here, skin them out, get them hung in the cooler. Get them cooled down so they don't go bad.
You got to get right down to bat on a day like today.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of them be coming in where they still got vital parts, personal parts that should be cut out. They ain't cutting them out, and the esophagus, just reminder to cut them out because it makes your neck go bad and your quarters go bad real quick.
For Thin Air, this is Brian Behuth in Pagosa Springs, Colorado.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is a project of the High Country Community Radio Coalition. You might be listening to KRZA Alamosa, KAJX Aspen, KGNU Boulder, KDNK Carbondale, or KBUT Crested Butte, or possibly KBUR Durango, KSJE Farmington, KZMU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KPCW Park City, KRCL in Salt Lake City, or KOTO in Telluride. Thin Air is funded by your local public station and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.